Call the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
It's a serious question.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I'm your host, Brian Karam. It's our Sunday show, Just Ask the Press, where we talk to our panel of experts. Michael Zeldin, former federal prosecutor, John Bennett, editor at large at CQ Roll Call, and a columnist extraordinaire. So we're here to talk about the issues of the week. Stick around for this important message that pays the bills, and we'll be right back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth. With Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. It's Just Ask the Press Sunday, where we talk about the issues of the week with Michael Zeldin and John Bennett. And we're going to start off, I think, with probably one of the biggest issues that I think has gone underreported in the press for quite a while, but it's now rearing its ugly head, and that's the specter of nuclear war. And that's because Putin this week raised a flag saying that there was a referendum in the four eastern provinces of Ukraine, and in that referendum, they are now part of Russia. He has said that he will defend Russia with nuclear weapons, that he's not bluffing, and that the United States set the tone and a precedent during World War II that he will use to defend Russia. Now, in all fairness, in speaking with my contacts at the DOD and in national security, at the NSC, they're saying that they are keeping a close eye on it and they haven't seen any move towards tactical nukes in the battlefield. But that doesn't mean that they're not worried, because, of course, Putin has doubled down there and not backed off, even though he's losing and he has troops surrounded in eastern Ukraine. So with that being said, it plunges us closer to nuclear war, honestly, than at any time that I can remember since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I remember that because our next door neighbor built a bomb shelter, not a fallout shelter, but an actual bomb shelter that he could live in for 2 months, and promised my mom and dad that they could bring their kids into the bomb shelter, but they'd shoot anybody else in the neighborhood if that went down. And Michael, I'll start with you. I mean, you have to remember that time far better than I do. You were in middle school, I believe, then, right?
I was one of those kids who in middle school had to do the air raid drills, where surprisingly, and I didn't realize this, hiding under a desk or pushing your face against a locker made you safe from a nuclear attack.
Duck and
so I think that probably we just need to get more desks out distributed across the country.
Hey, now you joke, but TK Jones, Reagan's former Undersecretary for in the DOD, Undersecretary of Defense, said famously that with enough shovels, and that was the name of the book, Reagan, Bush, and Nuclear War in the early 80s, he argued that if we have shovels and dig holes and throw doors on top of it, that we'd survive. And with enough shovels, we'd all be okay. It's frightening that that was ever the tone of the U.S. government. But it's even more frightening to me today that we're back where we were in the early 60s. Yes.
Well, we are, and it's been that way really since the times of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that there was this, I guess, competition between the then Soviet Union and the United States, and then it got escalated to other countries, and it's an ever-present threat. And that's why the strategic nuclear talks, the SALT, and all those things are so important in order to mitigate this threat.
But you say something, you point on something, and John, I'll point to you for this. I mean, because you're younger than we are, you probably don't remember the duck and cover drills. I remember those in school, all the way through grade school and all the way up to sixth grade, where they would call, you know, duck and cover. If you duck and cover, you'll be safe. But Michael points something out. We've been under this threat since the end of World War II, but yet it's something we don't report on very much, is it?
No. I think one risk here is that, you know, folks my generation and younger, a bit desensitized to war after Iraq and Afghanistan and the global war on terror. So I think it goes underreported in part because of that. You know, it doesn't seem like such a threat because, you know, for some people that I work with, for instance, we've been at war since they have had memories, you know, they're in their late 20s or mid 20s, some of the younger colleagues. So I think that's one reason. My worry here is that Mr. Putin is calculating that, well, we know what he wants to do. He wants to restore the Soviet Union to its full land and ethnic territories and construction. My worry is that if he can't do that, he will simply destroy the motherland. He sees himself as a once in a generation, this is my assessment, he sees himself as a once in a generation Soviet leader. And if he can't restore it, no one can. So if I can't restore it, or, you know, if the Americans and their allies won't allow me to, won't stand aside and allow me, then to hell with it, I'll just blow the whole thing up. Because no one else in the rest of human history can do it. It's my job to do, and I'll just blow it up if I can't restore it.
So that's pretty damn depressing, isn't it?
Nothing we're going to talk about today is exactly uplifting.
Yeah. Well, on that uplifting note, that's, I wonder, I think it's an indication of what he's lost and the fact that he is losing in Ukraine. And at the same time, it's frightening because to me, it's like a cornered sewer rat. And, you know, right. he's gonna lash out. He's not gonna go gentle into that good night.
Yeah, it's like a wounded animal.
Yeah,
You know, that's what you worry about in conflict situations like this, with a leader who's armed with nuclear weapons. You know, at what point does that become to them? It might not seem logical to us, but to that leader, at what point does hitting the nuclear button seem logical as a last resort to try to win? I don't sense that Mr. Putin is thinking logically right now like the rest of us, and that's really what worries me.
There you go. Michael, final thoughts on this issue before we move on?
Well, the word logical is sort of loaded. He's thinking logically from his point of view, which is, the West is an occupying entity. You know, the United States is an occupying entity throughout the world, that we're not equal partners, but we're colonialists. And that these regions, these four regions, were essentially inappropriately taken from the Soviet Union against the will of the people back in 1991. And he's there to restore that injustice. And so, you know, logic is through the eyes of the beholder. But the problem is that we have our logical way of looking at things. He has his logical way of looking at things. We each think the other's point of view is illogical, which makes for conversation and negotiated settlements much more difficult.
Yes, but then at the end of the day, mutually assured destruction. We all have to recognize that the launching of nuclear weapons will assure everyone's destruction. Yes? I mean, is that still in the mix, or have we jettisoned that?
No. That the consequences of failure are clear. All the only point I was trying to make is the two superpowers have just a different worldview. And so the question is, as in any sort of lawsuit or disagreement, how do you bridge the gap so that there isn't, in this case, nuclear annihilation? How do you do that? And who has the, you know, sort of the intelligence strategically to figure out how to make this work?
Well, I think the answer to that question is Xi Jinping in China, the president of China. I don't see anyone else who could step in and have the kind of influence over Putin to end this other than President Xi. It's certainly not President Biden. I don't think it's Mr. Macron in France. I don't see anybody else but the president of China.
Or the Indian prime minister.
Could be. Howdy Modi.
Both of them have kind of given him a stiff shoulder and at the same time not. And so they've kind of waffled on this issue since the beginning. I want to move on.
The lyric in Bob Dylan's One Too Many Mornings, right? It says, you are right from your side. I am right from mine. We're both one too many mornings and 1,000 miles behind. And that's sort of where we are. We're right from our side. He is right from his. From one too many mornings and 1,000 miles behind.
And anytime you can bring in a Bob Dylan lyric, I'm a happy camper. That's I'll move on now to the issue of the week in court. And that was Judge Cannon, who overrode the special master and said that, you know, the special master in the Trump case had said put up or shut up when it comes to telling us about the FBI planning evidence at Mar-a-Lago. And Cannon said, no, you don't have to do that. Is this further indication of the politicization of the Justice Department or of Cannon specifically? And Michael, I'll start with you, because it does show that she's bending over backwards, at least, at the very least, to accommodate Trump.
So backing up to understand the context, a special master is appointed at the request of Trump, and Judge Cannon, the district court judge, appoints one of the two people that Trump requested, this senior status judge, Deary, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan, and he's sitting as the special master. In one of his early orders in the case, he said to the Trump lawyers, look, I'm going to make the Justice Department give us one final, most comprehensive, detailed inventory of what was taken from Mar-a-Lago. I want you, Trump, thereafter, to look over this inventory and let us know whether there are any documents that are missing, or any documents that are inaccurately described, or any documents which you contend were not actually taken from Mar-a-Lago, implying something which was planted. And that seemed reasonable to the Justice Department, and they accepted that, but not so to Judge Cannon, who determined that the Trump lawyers would not have to make that declaration until after they reviewed the document. So on one hand, it's not such a big deal that she's asking that this be delayed until after they review the documents. But it seems to me, on the other hand, if you're asking for a certification that nothing was planted, that doesn't require a review of the documents. If there's something on that list that wasn't taken from your house and you know that, then a review of what was taken is not a prerequisite to declaring that which wasn't taken. And why it was important to Judge Deary, and he said you can't have your cake and eat it too, is that you can't be out there in the public airways claiming that evidence was planted and not coming forward with evidence to support that. And so I'm going to ask you to do that. But Judge Cannon, perhaps to accommodate Trump for political purposes or just because she has a bona fide legal belief that this is the best way to proceed, has overruled her own special master. Now we find ourselves in a situation where we have to wait until essentially December to get answers to these questions.
Well, let me follow up with that, because you wrote something here that I had noticed myself. You said she has extended the timeline for a final review report and rejected rolling reports as groups of documents were completed per Trump's request, right?
No. Sorry, let me just make sure that you're reading what I wrote, or that I wrote, what I should have written clearly. The special master said, as I review a tranche of documents, I will send them forward and we'll deal with this on a rolling basis so that this can be expedited. DOJ said, that makes sense. Trump said, no. We don't want to go that fast. It's too fast for us. And the irony of that,
Trump said it would hurt him, right?
Well, but the irony of it is that we're in this position of having a special master in all this because the Trump legal team filed a motion for an injunction saying, unless we did this immediately, there would be irreparable harm to the former president. And that's what Judge Cannon agreed to. And now that they've gotten their way on the review with the special master, all of a sudden, this irreparable harm, we got to get this done right away, argument seems to have fallen by the wayside, and they're just happy with just sort of foot dragging, slow the process down. So it shows sort of the inconsistency in what they're telling the court.
It's hypocrisy. I mean, to me, it's he says, the special master says, you can't have your cake and eat it too. And Judge Cannon is going, yeah, you can.
Well, what she's saying in some sense, if you want to give her the benefit of the doubt, what she's saying is,
oh, you do.
Well, I'm saying if one wants to give her the benefit of the doubt, what she's saying is, we'll get to these declarations, but after the documents are reviewed. And what the other side is saying is, you don't need to review the documents. You know, it's, again, I'll quote Bob Dylan, and the line is, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. You don't need to review these documents in order to know whether something was planted or not.
John,
I just throw my.
I see you bobbing in there. I know you.
I know. It's opportunism. We argued this, but that happened. So let's take that and try to wring out every little advantage in that. And then if she rules against them, they'll try to get the best out of that. And right now, delaying helps him. It's just more
disingenuous.
This is what he does. This is just what he does.
Yeah, I guess the difference here is between this and, say, January 6th committee is there's really no clock that he can run out, because the decision to indict or not indict is that which resides solely in the Justice Department. So if the Justice Department says, you know what, we're not going to be bothered with all this Judge Cannon delay stuff and Trump changing his mind about whether this is important or not important, that has to be rushed or not rushed, we're just going to make our charging decision. And so everything resides in their hands. They just want to do it comprehensively before they make a decision. And that's what they should do. But if these roadblocks keep being thrown in front of them, they'll have to make a decision about how to proceed.
I think it's just an indication of Donald Trump trying to take advantage of every situation and make it to the best of his ability, despite whatever in hell is being, whatever he argues on Monday is not what he's going to argue on Tuesday. If it benefits him to argue differently on Tuesday, he'll do that.
But could I just say, though, you know, as a lawyer, and you know, not related to Trump, in particular, which is, this is what
lawyers
defense
do.
Counsel should do. I think I said to you once before, the fellow who I worked for, Alan Raywood, who was my legal mentor, when I asked of him, what was the thing which he is most proud of as a defense attorney in his life? And he's argued in front of the Supreme Court at this point, and he's had a very illustrious Justice Department and private sector career. He said, the thing which I'm most proud of is I once got a judge to give me an indefinite continuance. And so that's it. If you can get definite continuance, you know, you've wow. hit the jackpot. And so this is what this, you know, it's that, you know, that dog, that joke about the frog and the scorpion, the water is rising and the frog is on the
this
side
is
of the
what I do
with the scorpion. And he says to the frog, give me a ride across the water. And he says, no, you're a scorpion. You're going to sting me. And he says, why would I sting you? If I sting you, we'll both die. And frog says, good point, hop on. And middle of the lake, the scorpion stings him. And the frog says, why did you do that? He says, I'm a scorpion. That's what I do.
Yeah, right. Why are you going to do that? We're both going to die now. This is what I do.
That's what I do. So there's a lot of that's what lawyers do.
Sure. Well, John? The clock. Yeah, Michael's right that there's no clock. He's right. The clock, though, in my head, and I suspect in Trump's head, is the political clock.
That's
and,
the one.
Yeah. And I think, and I'm not saying I agree with his calculus, but I think Trump's calculus is if he can get to the point that he declares he's running for president again, that it'll change everything. It'll change Garland's mind or this prosecutor's mind or that attorney general's mind. I'm not saying that I agree with that because I don't, but I think that's Trump's play. So yeah, I think in his mind, there is a clock and there is a reason to delay. I don't necessarily think that's, I think that Garland would indict candidate Trump or citizen Trump. I don't think he's going to make that.
On that
there you go.
Especially if citizen Trump manipulates the system to become candidate Trump in a transparent effort to undermine the investigation. And I don't think Garland falls for that.
I don't either. I agree with you there, Michael and John. I think we've all said before, I think that Garland is probably, people keep giving him grief. And I always say, look, it's far easier to commit a crime than it is to prosecute the crime. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot longer, especially if you're aiming for Trump, the slippery little bastard, you're going to have to be very good. And so Garland, I think, is taking his time for a good reason, and hopefully his aim is true.
Yep.
But we'll wait and see. For the love of God, I don't know. But that brings us to the other part of this after Cannon, is that the story that came out this week that the National Archives still says they do not have all of the Trump papers. So even after a search at Mar-a-Lago, they're claiming they still don't have everything. Where does that take us?
Well, it depends on what they're looking for. What the Justice Department has to evaluate is whether or not there is an intentional failure to disclose additional documents. Now, the National Archives has said that the types of documents that they're looking for are non-official electronic messaging accounts that were not copied and forwarded to the official electronic messaging. So if you use your private cell phone for something that is part of your government activities, you need to forward it so that it becomes part of the official. This is the Hillary Clinton stuff in a way. And that what they're saying is that Trump advisors, Navarro and others, may not have done that, and that Trump may not have done that, because, you know, he's known for using his own private cell phone to contact people. All of those things are official records that need to be transferred. And so what the archives is saying is to the DOJ, could you please look into whether or not it should initiate legal action for the recovery of these records unlawfully recovered and retained? And I can say, Brian, that as a prosecutor, if Donald Trump is still holding on to documents in Mar-a-Lago that were requested by the Justice Department, either by subpoena or by search warrant, and that he knowingly hid them from those pursuits, I think that makes it impossible for the Justice Department not to indict him for obstruction of justice.
Well, that's a bombshell. John?
I think that's right. I think that I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, that sounds would take this. It sounds like that's where Garland would take this. And it sounds like, as of everything we know right now, that is as likely an outcome as anything else. also as likely an outcome is that all that happens while Trump is the Republican nominee for president.
Yeah, that's where I'm going. Where do you, and you know, you've covered, we've both been on the Hill this week, right? So we know how his minions are going to spin this up on the Hill. How does this fall out in the January 6th hearing, you think?
I think they're going to run out of time. They had to delay this week because of Hurricane Ian, and Stephanie Miller is a congresswoman from Florida. And the storm, at least it was projected to pass right over her district. I think it turned south of there, but you know, so they had to delay, and now they're on recess. They're gone. They passed a government funding bill. See you in November. They're going to go campaign. I mean, they can come back and have a hearing, but you know, that's not where everyone's attention is now. They're in full campaign mode. The select committee, just like any committee set up like this, it expires when this Congress expires, and that's, you know, right after New Year's. And it looks like I still think we're going to have a Republican House, not a big majority. So that committee's going away. You know, its charter's not going to be renewed. It's already October 2nd somehow. So, you know, they might have one more public hearing. Then they have to do the hard work of pulling it all together in a report, then decide, and at the same time decide if they're going to make criminal referrals. All that will take up the committee's time and attention behind closed doors. So, and again, as I've said the entire time, they haven't connected a lot of those dots straight to Trump.
No, they haven't.
If they had that, you know, I don't think they, you know, speaking of indefinite delays, this last public hearing that was set for last Wednesday, it's kind of an indefinite delay now. If they had those goods, I think we would have seen them by now. So I'm not sure how anything could really affect what we're going to get in that final report or the criminal referrals. I think we've seen the best of what they have.
I don't think they're going to be able to stick the landing. In other words, yeah. I think that's just going to be a sloppy little landing, and it will go nowhere.
Unfortunately. I agree.
But when you look at that, how do you think we've covered that angle in the press?
That the Jan 6 committee, yeah, is going to, I hate to say it, it's going to be something of a dud at the end of the day. Well, I think we have to kind of look in our crystal ball and use what we know about the media, and current situations and future situations. We are about to go ourselves into full campaign mode.
Yes.
So, you know, we're going to have really good congressional reporters who have really good sources on the committee, and they're going to be in Georgia and Pennsylvania and Michigan doing, they're going to be in campaign reporter mode. So I think this thing has a really good shot. And then after the election, we're going to go into full mode of, here's what next Congress is going, yes, to look like. Here's what Kevin McCarthy is going to do. Here's what Jim Jordan's going to do.
Here's what the Supreme Court's going to do. They're right, starting their new session.
Right, court decisions. And then, oh, by the way, it's the holidays right after the election. So, and people are going to be focused on Thanksgiving and Christmas gifts and seeing their families maybe for the first time in a few years. And then here's this report from the January 6th committee that comes out, I don't know, December 12th. And so I think they are on a glide path to, we'll remember them. We'll remember them, the three of us, folks like us. But, you know, who else is going to?
Last question before we go to the break, and I guess this is with the Supreme Court. We'll start. Michael, what do you think is the Supreme Court is now in session, and their prognosticators are saying, good Lord, watch out. They're going to destroy the world. How dangerous is the coming Supreme Court session?
Well, again, it depends on where you sit. You know, for some, the Supreme Court is not going to do anything that's damaging of the world, but rather it could be enhancing of the world. Others, just the opposite. And so we have to always be careful when we ask a question like that to make sure that we're answering it from our own point of view, from my own point of view.
From your point of view.
From my point of view, there are some important cases pending before the Supreme Court, like Dobbs was last term, that will have profound impact on the way we organize ourselves as a community.
And those issues are?
Well, there are too many to account for, but they all involve sort of the social contract. In broad terms, they all involve the social contract by which we have lived for all these years. The authority of financial institutions to control things, the environmental impact of certain types of business arrangements, the nature of rights that criminal defendants have. All of these types of things are social. They're all compact issues, contract issues. They're all social contract issues. So it doesn't make a difference whether it's LGBTQ rights or reproductive rights or prisoners' rights or other. We're being asked as a society, how do we want to organize ourselves? This is the question when they say democracy is being threatened by what's going on. The Supreme Court also has to ask itself, how do we want to be organizing ourselves as a society? What are the principles that guide us? What are the moral imperatives that should guide us? And those things are overarchingly more important than any particular case, in my view. And I think that the manner in which the current composition of the Supreme Court wants to organize themselves or wants us to organize ourselves is not the type of community of relations among people that I think is healthy.
John?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's any mystery where the court's headed. I'm not as well versed probably as Michael on the cases that.
Well, the two that stick to my mind that Michael brought up, LGBTQ rights, but of course the big one I think that we're going to be facing is voting rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it boils down to, if we're more conservative in those rights, there are going to be a lot of people pissed off, as Michael said. They're arranging themselves in a fashion that most Americans don't favor. And I don't think we've done a very good job in the press of letting people know exactly what it is we're facing in this particular court session.
Yeah, I that's probably true. We tend to cover these things and then dip out pretty quickly. You'll have a stand up somebody outside the court and we'll cover it and we'll give it a story or two and then move on because, you know, next Wednesday or Monday, they're going to read out some more decisions. The fact that vast majority of Americans wanted to keep Roe on the books, that certainly didn't stop this court. So I don't see why they're not really concerned with polling data. They have a certain, like Michael said, a certain view, worldview or governing view or whatever, about how society should be arranged, and it's out of step with most of the country. But I don't think they'll care very much. I think you'll see the Chief Justice, as he's done from time to time, because he does think about the legacy of his court. So I think you'll see from time to time, he'll probably break with the conservative bloc. I think he'll probably try to get creative and do it in a half-assed kind of way, and he'll write some weird decisions of his own, trying to kind of split the baby there. So I think it's just more of the same. I'm not a court expert by any means, but I think we know exactly what we're about to get.
Yep, screwed. We're going to take a short break. And Michael, you quoted Bob Dylan. I'm going to quote Yeats before we go to the break. The ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. So think about that for a little bit. We'll stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. Seriously. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. With me are Michael Zeldin and John Bennett. I am your host, Brian Kerriman. John, we're going to talk a little bit now. I'm going to give you the first word on this. We're going to talk about some of the aging leadership problems in this country, but of course, we can't do that without first addressing the religious experience of a Trump rally last night. The organ grinder in the background. It was frightening to me, but it was. I also hearing the organ and being a sports fan. Here we go. I'll bring sports into it already. The Nats game. I felt like at any minute I was going to hear dun 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 charge. But thank God we didn't. Or a hymn. I thought at any minute we might hear a hymn. But what's going on with the Trump rally these days? You were covering it.
Boy, I don't know. I was covering it. Full disclosure, speaking of sports, I was also watching a fair amount of football at the same time. But I did have ears and eyes on Trump for most of the rally. I didn't stick around for the whole thing. But it hit different last night. It felt different. It felt more charged. There was a lot more energy in the hall where he was in Warren, Michigan, or the venue where he was in Warren, Michigan. It just seemed like an angrier experience. You had a lot of, I mean, you always get wild claims at Trump rallies, right?
Right.
But last night we had Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was there for some reason. I thought she was from Georgia, not Michigan, but I guess she was campaigning for some of the GOP candidates up there, and she was invited to speak. And you know, she said that Democrats want Republicans dead, and the killings have already begun.
And yeah,
I don't know if anyone except her knows exactly what she's talking about. You had a lot of other claims. Some of the statewide candidates, Republican candidates who were on the speaker's list, and Trump called up to speak, and of course, kiss the ring. That's the number one duty when you're called on stage at a Trump rally.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot more just flirting with violence, and the rhetoric seems a lot more violent. Now we do have the context of Jan 6 and the fallout.
Well, and the context of Trump. I mean, Trump came out this week and threatened violence against Mitch McConnell, who's right, a Republican, and said, you know, he must have a death threat to want to kind of deal with the Democrats. So, I mean, the violence has been ongoing and the threat of it since January 6th.
Yeah, and he seemed, Trump himself last night seemed a lot more desperate and angry. And we all know why that is, all these investigations and court filings and going back and forth. And
plus the polls were not having as broad of appeal as he once had.
Right. So, you know, he's trying to maintain his grip on the party, and he might sense that that's slipping a little bit. So, you know, I just more lies. You know, he claimed last night, I think, to have almost zero debt, which we know that's not, true. And just to me, he's attacking Republicans as much as he's attacking Democrats anymore, it seems like. So it's just a different tone. It's, you know, you used to could chuckle at some of this stuff that Trump would say at a rally. And now it's just a lot darker.
Yeah, it's frightening. But Michael,
growing up in the South, the organ last night, why in the world would a politician have an organ playing behind him? The only time I remember that is when then President Obama went to the funeral in Charleston after the church shooting. And of course, the organ started and President Obama eventually starts singing Amazing Grace. Well, that worked. That fit. That was a very fitting moment for President Obama to do that because they were grieving people who were shot in a church. But why in the world would Donald Trump have an organ? It just seems like they're trying to make this. And you've used the word cult, you know, on this podcast. And I've tried to resist that. But boy, that really felt cultish last night.
Religious cultish. And right. But there is a precedence. Right. And before any of us were alive, and it was something that H.L. Mencken wrote about, and that was William Jennings Bryan. Remember his Cross of Gold speech. And he was a populist too. And he used that tent revival organist crap back then. And I think Trump has fallen back on that. And we don't have an H.L. Mencken covering him to give him shit all the time. But the fact of the matter is that's what happened. But Michael, you had a great a point you were going to make before about Trump and his rallies. Go for it.
So the question that you ask, Brian, all the time on this podcast conversation is, how did the press do? And when reading about the Trump rally, because I don't watch television frequently, I wondered
to myself. You're a wiser man for it.
I wondered to myself, why is this getting that much coverage? I mean, this is an undeclared candidate for political office who is giving speeches about an election which he says was unfairly stolen from him. And he has his acolytes like Marjorie Taylor Greene coming all the way from Florida to his rally to say pretty much the same thing. And I don't know why it's newsworthy. I guess I asked the question, if any other former presidential candidate decided that they were going to hold a rally, a candidate who came close to winning, Hillary Clinton or Al Gore or Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party, if any of them held a rally someplace and people showed up to listen to them, would it get the wall-to-wall coverage that Trump is getting? And I think the answer is no. And I think you can say, well, none of them is Trump. But does the media, in fact, by giving him oxygen like this, allow him to remain part of the discourse as fundamentally as he is? And would we be better off if we just stop covering this craziness? And if he declares for president, then he's a public figure again, and we can, you know, do what we think is appropriate for him. But I hearken back to 2016, when anytime Trump opened his mouth, media covered it wall to wall, giving him all this free airtime. And I think that there is a lot of data which indicates that that was very helpful to his campaign. And I think that I'm not in the media, you guys are, or the media collectively, not you two personally, are making the same mistake again. And that, I don't quite get it, other than the economics of he gets clicks or eyeballs. And are we still all about that?
Well, in so much as he is, I will say this way, as an editor, if I have to make this decision, I don't know that I would go wall to wall with Donald Trump. I think that's a bit much. As a former president, what he says could indeed be newsworthy, and I'd send a reporter to cover it. It was Carter, who had his 98th birthday, that was covered. It wasn't wall to wall, but he's a former president. So there's, for that odd reason, former presidents get covered. Now, Donald Trump is under investigation for a variety of things. So what he says could be newsworthy. Actually, in Donald Trump's case, what he says could incriminate him. So that's, you do want to cover it for that reason. But I too am sick to death of wall-to-wall coverage of Donald Trump. John, you actually work as an editor these days. Your approach to it?
Let me flip it for a second. Let's say someone goes out and tries to harm Mitch McConnell or his wife, Elaine Chao, who worked in the Trump administration as a cabinet secretary.
He disparagingly referred to as?
As Coco Chao, which is a very racist thing to say. She's of Asian descent, of course. So let's say we don't cover any of this. We don't cover his Truth Social post about Coco Chao and Mitch's death wish for, you know, trying to cut a spending bill at the end of the year. So we don't cover any of it. We just all ignore it. And then something happens. Well, the media is going to get criticized for not having covered the thing that incited the violence. So, you know, it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. And I'm thinking about, you know, if we don't cover it, that's how I think about it. Like, if we don't, we do have a responsibility. If the most influential politician in the country, declared or not, for anything, dog catcher or president, we do have a responsibility to give people information. Now, we can quibble on whether we do a good job of that. Trump's smart enough.
I don't think we have to quibble. I think we suck.
Well, and Trump's holding these rallies on Fridays and Saturday nights for the most part. And it's not intentional. But let's face it. He's not getting the A team. You know, yeah. you're not sending one of your best political reporters to Warren, Michigan on a Saturday night. You know, you're probably going to send a more junior person. You may just send a camera and a producer, or something like that. So, you know, it's not getting the A team, so to speak. And that's an editorial decision, but hey, we're people too. We have families, we have lives, and we're also running a marathon in these newsrooms, and newsrooms are shrinking. So, you know, you're not going to devote one of your best five reporters to a Trump rally on Saturday night.
Oh, you may only have five reporters.
Because you need them starting Monday morning. You need them to work five 14-hour days.
Right.
So, you know, we got to think, you know, you got to think about all that.
I
do think we have a responsibility to cover Trump. I do.
I think we have a responsibility to cover Trump. It's the wall-to-wall coverage. It's the live coverage of his events. I can turn on and still see live. Here's what pisses me off as a reporter, right? It pisses me off that I can turn on the TV and watch a Trump event live and yet on the network. And yet something that the president of the United States does, who's elected and in office, is not covered live.
That's true.
And maybe more to your point, Michael, that's where we're going with it. It's annoying as shit. And I'm going to use that word. It's annoying as hell. And frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. it's annoying as hell to me that the president of the United States, who can come out and announce something on the South Lawn, is not. And it's a national event, and it's a policy that affects millions of people, hundreds of millions of people in the U.S. is not picked up live, and yet Coco Chow gets carried. You know, Donald Trump and his slurs and his irrational speech is covered and put up live. That to me is, as an editor, where I would draw the line. I put the guy that's elected to office, who's responsible to the U.S. right now, him I would put up live. Donald Trump, I'd have a soundbite from. Here's the latest craziness from Donald Trump. By the way, he said X, Y, and Z, and that would be the calculus. Once he's declared, if he declares as a candidate, then that's different. But I think right now, unfortunately, we're playing into Donald Trump. And you're right. It's the hardest decision you're going to make in a newsroom. With shrinking numbers of reporters, you're saying, you know, your top five reporters, you can't assign them on a Friday or Saturday night. Shit, you may be in a newsroom that only has five reporters.
That's right.
And so it's difficult as hell for us to make that decision. But I think because he is clickbaitable and because he is provocative, that we cover him. But to me, after a while, it's like going out and watching somebody drop their pants in Moonis. I just don't really give a shit what Donald Trump says. And I get freaked out by what he says, and it's dangerous what he says. But how much of what we're doing when we cover him live encourages him to continue?
Probably a lot. I mean, he's the one who talks about the red lights back there.
Yeah. Michael?
I think that when you give demagogues oxygen, they get to remain demagogues longer. And yes, I hear there's newsworthiness to some of the things he says, but not to the extent that he is covered. You know, if I were running a newspaper, would anything that Donald Trump said about the election being stolen, and that if he were still president, that he would negotiate some settlement on the pipeline. I mean, this is not news. This is just the ramblings of a old man, you know, who could be sitting in a park on a bench with, you know, mucus on his outer jacket. He's not, to me, relevant until he becomes relevant.
So you were at his last rally. He is the old man sitting with mucus on his jacket, and we covered. Which brings me to the next issue, and that is the aging leadership in this country. I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican. We've got two septuagenarians who are heading the ticket. And it seems to me at some point in time, and I mean, even, you know, Obama is I think, over the hill at this point. Hell, he was in his 50s and he's gone. But there doesn't seem to be much bench strength in either one of these political parties to bring in somebody younger. How dangerous is our aging leadership to the vitality of our democracy? Who wants to take that one first?
Sure, I'll take this one. I was just looking up of the congressional leadership. I think Chuck Schumer is the youngest at 71.
Holy shit.
This is something that we've covered over the years at Roll Call, especially with House Democratic leadership. I'm sorry, Kevin McCarthy is the youngest. I was thinking right now of the Democratic side, but Kevin McCarthy is the youngest. But
how young is he?
I will have to look that up while I talk, but I can do two things at once, Brian, not three, however. Mr. McCarthy is 57. So apologies to the minority leader, the soon-to-be speaker probably. Anyway, we have covered this, and we have focused largely on House Democratic leadership. Of course, Nancy Pelosi is in her 80s. Steny Hoyer is no spring chicken. Neither is Mr. Clyburn from South Carolina, who's the number three House Democrat. And the thing about House Democrats is there is no bench. There are young leaders who were ready to move up, but they've never been in leadership. They've never had an apprenticeship. They've never been allowed to. At least Mitch McConnell has groomed a few guys over in the Senate, John Thune, John Cornyn, who's getting up there in years, but John Cornyn could have a run as GOP leader in the Senate, and John Barrasso. Those are his three guys, Joni Ernst. So he's got some folks. He's groomed some possible heirs apparent. That's not the case with the Democrats. I think it is a big problem. We saw this week with our 79-year-old President Joe Biden, who was looking for a dead congresswoman at a hunger conference. And, you know, the White House did a terrible job of cleaning that up. It was one of the worst cleanup jobs I think I've ever seen.
They didn't clean it up. They created a bigger mess.
They made it worse, right. They made a bigger mess. They threw up all over themselves. And they couldn't just say, President Biden made a mistake. He's going to see the family here on Friday, and he will apologize then. He feels terrible. We're moving on. He's going to have a conversation with the family Friday about issues that were important to the congresswoman and repeat his condolences face to face. They just couldn't do that. They don't have that gene. They can't admit a mistake.
That goes back to the chief of staff, though. It's squarely, solely on him. And I cannot emphasize it enough. I know too many people in the media industry who have had discussions with Ron Klain, chief of staff. He is a martinet. And will not talk about it. They're so afraid of putting the president out because he will gaffe. Look, I don't think at the end of the day, this is an indication of dementia. This is who this president has been. You and I have covered him for 30 years. Biden has always made gaffes, but he's still better communicating. And I blame Ron Klain for this, but that's me.
I do think this is a sign of Biden's age.
Well,
the details of Walorski's death, the car accident, the two young staffers, the head-on collision, this doesn't happen every day.
No, it doesn't.
And I do think it's a reflection of his age. I mean, hell, I'll be 43 in December, and I forget things.
Right.
So you've got the age issue, which is a problem.
By the way, where are my car keys?
I can't ever remember where my glasses are. So
on your head.
There they are. But I do think it's a reflection of the man's age. They want to explain it away or try to spin it away. They're not very good at any of those things.
They're horrible at it.
Instead of just taking it on head on, they don't want to take anything head on. And former President Trump, 76. So, you know, and the election's 2 years away. And as Michael has said, he has shown signs of decline upstairs. So
he showed decline when he was in the White House.
but for me, the troubling thing is there are no young people. There's on either side, like you said, who have been in pressure situations and made tough decisions.
Right.
And I can't think of any who are ready. Maybe Gavin Newsom in California, but
I think it boils down to they're so afraid of admitting a mistake.
Right.
That and because they want to say that he's better than Trump. And I go, look, you know, great. It doesn't take much to be better than Trump. That's a low bar to pass over. For the love of Jesus, Mary and Joseph, could we aim a little fucking higher than just being better than Donald Trump? But they're so afraid that he'll be compared to Donald Trump that they won't ever admit a fucking mistake. And it drives me nuts. And that's now it. Maybe it's a sign of his age. I don't think it's a sign of some set of dementia. I've seen.
That's not what I'm saying.
So I want to clear that up. It may be a sign of forgetfulness of age. But I have not seen Biden acting in a manner, and I've been in front of him as recently as this week. I've not seen him. I've seen him work for an hour shaking hands, you know, glad handing out in the sun. I don't think it's dementia. I just think it's an aging Joe Biden.
He's 79.
Michael, we haven't heard from you yet.
So I guess the question is, if you were to make an admission that I made a mistake, how would the coverage differ from if you sloppily try to cover over it? I can't, except for maybe Ronald Reagan, who sort of apologized for not really realizing that Iran-Contra was an issue. I'm trying to find examples where presidents said, "I made a mistake. I'm sorry," because I don't know how that would be covered by the media. Maybe the better thing is just to continue to deflect and move on. Because, I mean, if Joe Biden says, you know what, I made a terrible mistake. I forgot about the April car crash. That's on me, you know. And to John's point, I'm going to go talk to the family about my condolences and the issues that were important to the Indiana congresswoman, and see if we can, you know, have a bill in her name. The people that say, all right, that's fine, great, you know, let's move on. Or do they say, well, you know what, it's an example of his age that he couldn't remember. And they're already doing that. You know, I understand that, but
how can it be worse?
Do you never get out of that trap?
However, that being said, it's the right thing to do. It's and by the way, it's the thing that Joe Biden said he would do when he ran for president. He said, if I make a mistake, I'll own it and I'll admit it. And he's lied and hasn't done it. Well, to the point, I think it's Ron Klain who's the architect of it. But they have not done what they said they would do. And by the way, I do think that one of the keenest examples of why you should come forward is, you know, it's never the mistake, it's the cover-up, Richard Nixon, Mr. President. If I do not believe that Richard Nixon would have gone through the shit that he went through, if he had said, yeah, we fucked up, sorry.
Except I think that we live in an age where the press sort of is lying in wait to find mistakes. It's much easier to
report. We'll invent them.
I understand that, but it's much easier to cover stories from and he said that Poland is not under the Iron Curtain, as opposed to the context of the Ford speech and what was his geopolitical policies. I mean, it's just much more complicated to talk about policy than it is to talk about, the easy low-hanging fruit of, oh, he forgot this congresswoman had passed away. And so let's just talk about that endlessly, because that will get clicks and eyes. And if I'm Ron Klain, I'm thinking, do I want to buy into the narrative that my president is old and declining mentally by having him come out and say, I made a mistake. Because maybe he's thinking that just plays right into the narrative that he's not, you know, able to continue to be president or to be able to run again. I mean, it's not a simple question for Klain.
No, it's not. But I think since he thinks we're all fools, he's going to play us that way. But
I just thought they once again looked silly.
Yeah.
He's looking for a dead congresswoman. Just say he made a mistake. I think, for me, and this is covering it, following it day to day, my biggest problem was you know, Corinne was talking to those reporters who were asking very legitimate questions about a 79-year-old leader with nuclear codes in his pocket. It wasn't almost justifiable to ask about it. You couldn't justify asking about it. And I just thought they looked really silly.
I think they looked very silly. I thought the answers were puffery and poorly answered.
And condescending.
I don't think we did a very good job asking pointed questions on that. I think the question I would have asked is, Kareem, the president of the United States made a mistake. There are those that are concerned that mistake is an indication of mental decline. What are you going to make his examinations, his physicals and his medical examinations available to us so that we can see for a fact whether or not there is a mental decline and you can put this issue to rest? And if you don't, then it continues the problem. And if you do, then it puts it to rest one way or another. But by not bringing that shit out, it only feeds the fuel to the fire and gives oxygen to people like Donald Trump, who's mentally deficient as they come. I think that we covered this issue poorly. I think the White House answered the questions poorly. And I think the president just fucking made a mistake. And, you know, it's like I go back to the movie, Animal House. Hey, you fucked up. You trusted us. But maybe we can make it better. That's, you know, at the end of the day, just you fucked up. Move on. That's I get it. And I really think that people, I know, Michael, you are doubtful of that, but I think that people would maybe not the press, but the people would give you the benefit of the doubt if you say, hey, I fucked up. You know, sorry.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with you. For sure, people would. But I don't know how the press covers mistakes. You know, the people may be forgiving and the press
is not,
less so. And so you have to figure out what to do under these circumstances. Nothing is simple.
No. And speaking of not simple, we're going to take another short break, come back with our final issue of the day, which is a little off topic politically, but we'll have fun with it. The NFL and its concussion protocol. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast. Again, that's at JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I'm your host, Brian Kerriman. With me again, former prosecutor, federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin, and editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call, John Bennett. And we've been talking about the great deal, the concussion-inducing politics of the United States. Now let's talk about the concussion-inducing play in the NFL. And full disclosure, as a former football player and as a former high school football coach, I am really, I don't even know where to go with the NFL anymore. I think the NFL's concussion protocol explains a lot when it comes to Herschel Walker and to Brett Favre, but that's not the issue. This week, it was a quarterback from Miami who was allowed on the field 4 days after an established concussion. And of course, J.J. Watt saying today, tweeting out that he was in AFib and he's going to be playing today. So, John, you're a football fan. How do you look at this? The NFL, to me, is just done. I don't trust anything.
Well, the NFL has managed to get us all hooked on their product. But, you know, if you're looking at their on-field product objectively, it's not very entertaining these days. Now, until about 3 minutes to go, because of the league has manufactured parity among the teams for the most part. You know, the Kansas City will bubble up or Tampa.
And manufactured is the key word.
They've manufactured the parity. Then they manufactured the rules package to help ensure as many close finishes every Sunday as possible. So you can have a 13-point game, run out to the supermarket, come back, and somebody's kicking a field goal trying to force overtime, or it's in overtime. And the pass interference rules, the roughing the passer rules, the late hit rules, the holding downfield rules, watch how those calls tick up in the fourth quarter or at the end of the first half or the middle eight of the two halves. And they use it to manufacture these outcomes. And meanwhile, like you said, everyone's getting their brain scrambled, like Tua, the Miami, Tua Tagovailoa, the Miami quarterback, who, you know, bounced his head off the turf two games ago, got up, tried to find the huddle, fell down, stumbled again. And luckily two of his teammates were standing there, or he might've hit his head on the turf a third time. And then played, of course, Thursday night. That's five nights rest. Played again, took another shot and was carted off the field. They strapped him down. His helmet was on. The team was all around him, concerned. And then, oh, by the way, and then he flies home from Cincinnati that night. What are you not supposed to do after one concussion, much less two in a few days? You're not supposed to fly. Yeah. So Tua probably should have been in the hospital. And now you've got J.J. Watt tweeting out that he was in AFib, and he's going to play a professional tackle football game with other monstrous athletes today. Oh, by the way, AFib can cause blood clot. Yeah. Where?
Yeah.
In your heart.
Yeah.
J.J. J.J. Yeah.
People I don't know will watch that game just to see if J.J. Watt dies.
And there is no oversight body for this league with what they're doing. And, you know, they're charging us now even more to watch their games, and to go to the stadium costs, you know, exorbitant amounts of money, and the product is bad. So you say that the NFL is done, but financially business is booming.
Yeah. For me, it's done. I'd rather watch a high school football game. Actually, I'd rather watch a middle school game where kids are having fun. And, you know, it's a real game. I think it's so freaking manufactured. You know, look at the amount. The first quarter it will pass, and there'll be what, one or two possessions for each team.
Yeah.
The fourth quarter, you'll have four or five possessions for each team. The last 2 minutes of the game will last as long as the first fucking quarter. There'll be a ghost call somewhere that you know what that was holding. What that was interference. What did he do? He waved at the guy. Oh, he looked at him funny. Ah, it's interference. You know, anything to keep the game close. I find it annoying as hell. Yep. So that's. But Michael, we haven't heard from you yet on this. And
so, I mean, just to be clear,
okay,
for a listening audience, this quarterback who's in his last contract year and looking for next year's bigger payday,
yes,
was concussed on a Sunday game. You could see, as you described, Brian, that he could not walk off the field under his own powers. Then Thursday, after that Sunday, he is concussed again and goes into the type of spasms of his limbs that indicate severity.
Yes.
The severity of a concussion. And so the question was, why was he allowed to play again on Thursday? And there are two things that come to mind about that. One is, why do they even have Thursday football games? Because it seems to me that the human body, after a Sunday football game, needs more than those few number of days to recover, because it's a brutal game. And two, how was he cleared? Now, the National Football League Players Association has fired their consultant on neuromotor injury stuff. But each team has team doctors who are right there on the field. They have EMS people right there. And yet he was allowed to get up and continue to play Sunday and play again on Thursday. And, you know, if you were a parent and this was your kid and this happened, you'd be filing a lawsuit for gross negligence. because it was gross negligence. And it's not clear to me from listening to the neurologists discuss this, how quickly, if ever, he's going to recover from this thing and what are the long-term implications for him. And, you know, in everything sports, the manager goes out to the pitcher in the sixth inning where he's just given up two hits back to back. And he says to him, how are you doing? Very few pitchers say, you know, manager, I'd like to come out. I think it's in the best interest of the team. They all say, right. keep me in, coach. I can do this. And then they give up a 3-run home run. And that's that. So some of this is on the players who sure. should say, you know what, coach, this is not the best thing. But these players are there to play. And when they're in their last contract year, they really, especially if you had injuries over the course of your career, as this quarterback has, they have every financial incentive to stay on the field.
That's right.
Too.
But I don't even think it's financial. I mean, kids, I mean, when we were playing as kids, right? You'd be in high school or even little league football. I mean, keep me in, coach, I want to play. I had a kid one time, he had a broken arm. It would look like a U. I mean, his whole forearm was shaped like a U. He goes, I can stay in. I'm going, no, you can't. You want to play. You're a player. You want to play. I get that. But I'm sorry. Go ahead, Michael.
No. So I'm saying, you know, we don't know if there's a pox on just the owners and just the organization, or there's also, you know, some amount of blame to go to the players. But whatever it is, whoever is to blame or whoever's are to blame, clearly they are not making this game any safer.
No, and the sad part of that is the helmets could be a lot safer. And there are indications that, you know, sometimes they're not made safer because they would look different than current football helmets. I mean, I remember wearing a football helmet, a Rydell football helmet in high school. The internal suspension was rope and a rubber plug. I mean, that was just, you know, that you got jostled around quite a bit. And if you want to see about the long-term effects there are a lot of, you know, well-known effects of the long-term effects of concussion. And like I said, you can merely look at Brett Favre or Herschel Walker and see that there are legitimate concerns about life after football with a lot of concussions. Both of those men suffered an abnormal, or, you know, maybe normal in the context of NFL football, but a shitload of concussions. And, you know, you have Brett Favre saying, you know, he didn't even remember throwing a couple of touchdown passes in a game. That's how concussed he was.
But he got hit a lot.
And he played longer, played more games than anybody else. And, you know, there might be a reason why he's nuttier than batshitty crazy.
Remember, he ran around a lot. He would try to extend plays to the last possible second a receiver might pop open. And he had a great arm, so usually he could deliver those balls. A lot of times, though, he threw them to the other team while also getting hit in the head really hard by a 315-pound defensive lineman.
Most of the injuries still helmet to helmet, or is it all sort? I mean, Tua, the Miami quarterback, got his head knocked against the ground.
Yeah, and let's be honest, and this is one of the things I've railed against for many years, is I do not think that pro football, college football, high school football, any football should be played on artificial turf. It's carpeted concrete, and you can make it as comfortable as you want, but it still doesn't have the give that natural earth does, and it's not as healthy to play on as real turf is. And having played on both, I can tell you for a fact, it's inherently dangerous to play a high-speed, impact, contact sport like football on artificial turf. They should be banned from every stadium.
There's a big difference in me pushing someone down on a turf and Micah Parsons from the Cowboys throwing somebody like a rag doll because, you know, he could probably bench press, you know, 480 pounds.
He could bench press both of us together.
Yeah.
And the other part, the other injuries that are exacerbated by turf, you know, you get your turf toe, you get your ankle turns, knees.
Yeah.
So it's those are to me, if the NFL isn't going to look at the problems of artificial turf, then it's just, to me, it's ridiculous to even have the discussion. And I think that helmet-to-helmet contact is, they don't even teach form tackling anymore, which, like what we taught as a coach, you know, you hit, you put your head to the side, you wrap, you hit, you wrap, you lift. I mean, you've got people just diving at people crazy out on the football field, and it's not conducive to good health. So, yeah, I think the NFL has a lot to answer for. Their product is, as you said, John, sucks, and it's not getting any better. And it's somebody's going to get, you know, you'll be watching, like I said, the Texans today. They suck, but you'll be watching it to see if J.J. Watt dies. There's
one eye closed, yeah.
Yeah. So that's it in a nutshell. Any last thoughts, any last words, Michael?
Well, I'm hoping that today is the day that Aaron Judge, his last game in Yankee Stadium for the season, hits the 62nd home run and gets the American League batting home run title. But
there you go. John, any final thoughts?
I just hope we get a little break this week from so much haymaker bad news. I mean, we talked about nuclear war, indicting a former president. The Biden incident this week was really bad as well. And talking about the January 6th riot, maybe we'll get a slower week and we can just, I don't know, talk about the rain or something.
Yeah, no hurricanes, no political conflagrations, no threat of nuclear war. And maybe the best news we can hope for is that Aaron Judge hits that 60-second.
I did have a question for Michael. Let's say Mr. Judge goes into a bit of a drought, but then in the first playoff game hits a couple bombs. Will you count him as the AL home run king?
No, regular season.
Regular season.
Okay, fair enough.
So there were two. We talked about this once. Babe Ruth hits 60 home runs in 154 games. Roger Maris hits 61 in 162 games. So two separate records. Judge ties Ruth hitting his 60th home run within the 154. He ties Maris hitting his 61st within the 154 to 162 range. Now we have four games left, including the one that they're playing as we speak. And it's in those four games that he has to hit the 62nd home run to be the American League League champion. The playoffs don't count.
And of course, the pressure is on. So,
Oh, yeah.
Just ask the question. I am your host, Brian Karam. Once again, thank you. Very memorable discussion today, guys. Look forward to the next one. We'll catch you next time.